Hey, welcome to the NZ Everyday Investor. Now, if you choose to be a self-directed investor, it makes sense to understand the current climate that we're in right now, but also where we are heading into, because we are investing for the future, right? Not just for today. Now, depending on your investment time frame, you need to really think about the paradigms that could change and the paradigms that could actually create new rails for outcomes in the future, right when you're dependent on the wealth that you've been accumulating. So I'm investing for the long term personally, right? With the vast majority of what I'm doing, I'm looking long term. So today you'll see that I'm trying to form a rounded view of what's potentially coming or not. Now, for a bit of a backstory, in the decades prior to the Great Depression of the 1930s, there was this immense technological transformation. Horses turned into cars, yelling over the fence turned into calling them on a telephone. Imagine how euphoric and unstoppable people felt during this period of time. That euphoria supercharged the share market, but then it snapped and brought people back to reality, and not a very good reality. Often, intense innovation and transformation creates euphoria. Now, that kind of feels like what's happening right now. We've spoken about GameStop recently on the show with Natalie Ferguson a couple episodes ago, and I think that whole GameStop thing, that was probably actually just a marker to indicate that perhaps some of the rules are starting to change out there with investing. So today we're going to start there, but then we're going to go a bit beyond that. Now, I found this episode really fun to do. I hope you enjoy it, but just remember that the chat gets a little bit technical in places. You may get it, you may not get it, it might be too simple, it might be too complicated, but I'd encourage you just to soak in it regardless. Some of it will stick in your mind. So there's something for everyone. Now, today I'm joined with the brilliant mind of Julian McCormack, investment specialist at Platinum Asset Management, and we're going to talk about how market movements of the past can teach us about where we are at today. Are we in a bubble, or is the party only just getting started? You are listening into the NZ Everyday Investor Podcast. This podcast is designed to help you, the everyday Kiwi, build wealth. We talk about a lot of things in this podcast, including property, shares, gold, managed funds, and Bitcoin. More importantly, we come from a New Zealand perspective and attempt to make a tricky and complicated subject matter a little bit easier to understand. I'm Darcy Ungaro, your host and authorized financial advisor. Hopefully, the content presented here gets you thinking about the tools available to build wealth and the ways that you can use them effectively. Please keep in mind that this isn't financial advice. Investments or strategies that are discussed today may not be suitable for everyone, so be sure to do your own research before acting on anything. Further information on today's show can be found by tapping or swiping over the cover art in your podcast player. Here you'll find some show notes, which will contain all relevant links related to today's topic. The NZ Everyday Investor Podcast is hosted on the podcast.nz network and is brought to you in partnership with Hatch, who lets you put your money to work in U.S. share markets. Hope you enjoy this episode. Let's make a start. Now, we had you on the show here, Julian, episode 88, 16th of March last year. Before all the fun stuff started to happen. And it was bizarre because I think one of the themes of that episode was talking about investing in a bubble. And then all of a sudden, bam, this giant pinprick called COVID came along and it all kind of came crashing down, but then it kind of built itself back up again. So that was kind of our last chat. I really enjoyed that because it was very intellectually stimulating. I found it quite cool because you have a really good background in history. So it's not like most people, when they're commenting on the state of play, we're looking at things right now, but you draw upon quite a lot of a backstory. So I'm keen specifically to start with your perspective on what's happening with GameStop. You know, what is that deal? What does that mean? And what is that symptomatic of?
So I think the whole GameStop thing has been somewhat misrepresented. It's sort of been presented as a sort of class warfare type deal with sort of the average Joe getting it over hedge funds in particular, you know, the hedge fund community within Wall Street. I don't think that's happened at all. I think elements of the hedge fund community have got it over other elements of the hedge fund community. And there's been a very, very thin, very, very pointy end of the spear that was retail. And, you know, I love some of these guys. You know, I think Roaring Kitty, you know, the, the guy who analyzed GameStop months and months ago. I think he's great. I think he has a really sensible approach to markets, and I think he did some good work about GameStop. But what I think happened was retail money helped to identify a particular vulnerability in a very, very high short interest stock, and it publicized it, and then other real money investors, so that's a judgmental thing to say, other large money investors saw that and thought, you beauty, I'm going to get you. And they did.
Mm. I guess what you're saying is like the retail crowd, this hive mind, the hooded warrior type image that you have, maybe they were the catalyst, maybe they were the spearhead, like you say, but once they made their move, it was basically just the battle of the hedge funds after that. Is that kind of what you're suggesting?
I think so. I don't have any data or quantitative evidence to demonstrate that, but yeah. That's the vibe I get talking to, you know, hedge fund guys who are friends of mine and our dealers and, you know, people in markets that, you know, that the, and then it gets presented as, you know, this class thing, or I don't know how you'd describe it, some sort of social faction type thing. I think that's people external to the system investing their own wishes about what would happen into the system. And I don't think it really happened.
Yeah, that's a good perspective on it. It's a nice balanced perspective to the story, I guess, of David and Goliath, which is kind of, that's the one that you kind of gravitate towards because it's such a cool story. And obviously you want to side with the underdog, right?
Go David, but
that's right.
I don't think there was a David involved, or not much.
Yeah, not much of a David. Yeah, and he had to go upstairs for dinner in his parents' basement. So exactly. That's all good. That's now, so Julian, in terms of what that points to, though, so it points to, or it highlights something, I guess, that maybe retail investors in particular or self-directed investors aren't normally that cognizant of. Are we actually playing a game which is fair? Do we have a chance to actually build new money, new wealth in the new world, or are the odds actually stacked against us?
I think if people, this is going to sound so motherhood and boring, but if people take, you know, if people spend less than they earn and they take the difference and they put that into markets systematically over time for their entire working life, they will retire rich.
Mm.
It's just life. So, mm.
It's so simple. People miss that though, right? It's not exciting enough to tell that story. That's the problem, right?
No, it's not. That said, the start point matters, because if I'd done that in Japan, starting in 1989, you know, that market's half where it was, you know, 30 years ago.
Mm.
So it doesn't mean you made no money, by the way. It doesn't mean you've halved your money because it fell and then bounced. So you would have, you know, if you're contributing all the way, you would have actually made some money along the way, but the internal rate of return probably was pretty ordinary from the start point. Mm. And why I raise that is Japan in 89 was one of the great bubbles of all time. And we're in something analogous. It's an attenuated version of it. It's not as bad, but it's bad. You know, we're a long way out the gangplank here in terms of valuation. And that part of the GameStop story, I think, is more important. There is, so this is a chaotic process now. You know, we're in a bubble and they can go anywhere. So there is very little predictive ability that one can have in short increments of time. And that sounds like I'm hedging the question, or, you know, avoiding the question or whatever. I actually want to get across to people the absolute impossibility of knowing outcomes in a chaotic system, right? It is just impossible. It's not that a little bit of additional work or data or a better model or whatever will give you the ability to predict anything. It doesn't. What it will give you is the ability to understand probabilities tomorrow, the next day, whatever. That is possible. That's absolutely possible. That's what we all do. But what must not be, you know, sort of assumed is that there's someone out there with the right model, the right system, the right data, and they know that that's not right. That's not right.
That's right. So we can kind of look at the weather patterns. We know that rain should be coming based on what we can see, but really there's no amount of due diligence that can allow you to know the mind of those clouds, right?
No, that's right. And then weather prediction is a good analogy, but somewhat flawed, because we, our understanding of the weather doesn't influence the weather. But our understanding of financial markets then influences financial markets. I'm minded of a terrific guy, Grantham, you know, from GMO, was saying in late 17, we might have a melt up. We might have a really incredible melt up, as was witnessed at the end of the, you know, 1990s and early 2000 cycle. And that kind of happened, but very briefly, and then markets corrected. And I think almost what happened was the narrative of the melt up prevented their ability to be a proper melt up, because people responded to it. Now, the other thing I want to emphasize about the GameStop thing as a general principle is dumb money comes to the table late. It happens in every cycle. And, you know, I don't mean to be offensive. It's just true. You know, if I was telling people with huge savings and cash on the sideline whether they should rush in to buy markets right now, hell no, absolutely not. And let me just demonstrate that. Market cap to GDP in US equities has never been higher. It's 100th percentile. Yeah. Even after last week, like remember after last week's fear and loathing, we're 2% off the highs of all time. So we ain't gone nowhere. Trailing PE, we're about the 99th percentile. Cyclically adjusted PE, so 10-year average earnings to price, we're at about the 97th percentile. Price to sales, about the 100th. Price to book, about the 100th. So we are about as expensive as we've ever been in the history of markets. But there's an interesting wrinkle on that, because the measure that we're not at an all-time high is equity valuation, so earnings yield, invert the P, get an earnings yield, to bond yield. Okay. That's the middle of the road. But what that's saying is, from the perspective of, from the position of all-time low yields, so all-time high bond prices, because yield and price are inverse, we're not that expensive. So relative to the highest price in the history of humanity, going back about 5,000 years, we have never been this expensive in bonds. But relative to that, we're not too bad in equities.
So when you're looking at the all the gauges in front of you as you're driving along, everything is pointing to
red hot.
Yep. Real red hot, you know, extreme speed. You've got low tire pressure, oil lights flashing on, batteries low, whatever. It's all bad, but we still cannot say it's going to be next week or next year even, because we're in uncharted territory. So when we're in uncharted territory, understandably, all indicators will misread because we haven't been there before. There's no reference point, right? Okay, so before we go any further, I'd just like to pause here to acknowledge the support of our partner, Hatch. As mentioned at the start of the show, Hatch can provide easy and affordable access to investing in the U.S. markets. So if you're listening in right now and you've thought about investing in the U.S. markets, well, we have a special offer just for you. Visit the show notes by tapping or swiping over the cover art in your podcast player, and you'll see a link there. If you sign up using this link, you're going to get a $20 credit for the first $100 that you deposit with them. That's a little something something to get you started in your investing journey. Thanks again, Hatch. Let's get back to the show.
Yep. And look, my guess is we've got a little ways to run. So the indicators that, or some indicators that would help one get a sense that this is really, really over, one would be central bank tightening. No, not on your life. I'm not totally up to date on what the RBNZ is doing, but I know they're being pretty accommodative. Over here, we're pegged at 0.1 to 2024. Wow. Phil Lowe was saying yesterday. Powell, I think, was saying in the States, we're not thinking about raising rates. And so that and they're quite clearly positioning everybody for a greater tolerance for inflation moving forward, and indeed a desire for inflation moving forward. Point one. The other point too is the economy is not slowing. The economy is violently reaccelerating.
It's kind of contrary to what you would think, because we've been told from a few other loud voices that the economy will eventually snap markets back into reality. That, but what you're saying is that stimulus has stimulated. Is that kind of what you're saying?
It's a whole layer cake effect. Yeah, stimulus is a big part of it. Absolutely, you're correct to identify it. But just the mechanical part, let's just start with where we were. So in Q2 and Q3 of 2020, major economies shrank by, 20 and 30%. Hmm. So the base effect is very low. Hmm. Right? We're starting from a low point. So if we just go back anywhere towards where we were in like 2019, we get this big growth effect just mechanically, right? So that shouldn't excite anybody. It's just a mechanical reality, right? Hmm. Point one. Point two, what have been the two big things that have kicked the guts out of the global economy since 2017? Because remember, in 2017, we had global synchronous growth. Mm-hmm. It was roughly trend growth. It wasn't that exciting. It was like 3.5% global GDP real. But anything economically exposed in markets was just flying. Our portfolio went ballistic. A bunch of people, looked like us, went nuts. What's happened since then? Trade war? Global pandemic. Mm-hmm. Trade war's over. That's done. So you're going to get lots of rhetoric, but just look at who's been, appointed by the Biden administration. These are very, very consensus names, right? So these are back to the Obama, Bush, Clinton, Bush years, total Washington consensus, with a veneer of, we're a bit tough on China, but that's over the top of what's underneath, which is that Washington consensus stuff. Open markets, free movement of capital, blah, blah, blah. Right. With the rhetoric over the top. And let me then just compare that to what just happened, which was a trade war, not between the US and China. It was between the US and everybody. So anybody, and let me count the ways. I mean, it was Thailand, Vietnam, South Korea, Japan, Germany, all of the EU, Canada, Mexico, Brazil, I'm forgetting a few, Turkey. They were all threatened with tariffs, had tariffs imposed, or were threatened with currency manipulation status by the Trump administration. Hmm. I mean, that's just never happened. Hmm. Yeah. Probably in the 30s, Hoot Smalley, that kind of stuff, probably might have been analogous to it. But that's gone. I mean, so the people who are being appointed by this administration are nothing like Navarro, Lighthizer, and Trump. And that separation from sanity is over. So why does that matter? Because there was a very, very significant industrial slowdown in the global economy from 2018 on. So imagine trying to buy a house and I say to you, I don't know if you guys have stamp duty, it might not be a good
analogy. No.
I don't know. So property tax could be zero or it could be 25. And I don't, next month, and I'm not going to tell you which it is. So you're going to buy a house next month? Well, I don't know. Because should I buy a smaller house because I have to pay more tax, or, should I just wait, or what should I do? Some people will transact, some people will have to, some people will be forced to. That has been what's happening in all global supply lines if anyone wants to export to the United States at all for the last 3 years.
Yeah.
So you've got this very significant diminution of activity. And we see that in activity stuff from like factory automation guys like Siemens, the Japanese machine tool makers, the robotics guys, all those guys. So Japanese machine tool orders have bounced violently off the low, and they are now at the lows of 2016, which was a real, real slowdown. So we had this. Right. So to put it another way, in billions of yen, Japanese machine tools were down like 70% and have bounced back up to about down half from where they were peaking 2018. So early 2018. So you've got this reacceleration of the industrial economy going on because supply lines were a little bit starved of capital for 3 years. And then we've got this reopening stuff.
And
it's real. That's going to happen. It's not going to be a simple fix. I mean, this stuff is complicated, and there's going to be bumps along the way, but probability of one, we're going to get back to something like normality. The time frame I wouldn't want to put to tie to band around, but I think it's relatively quick.
Just like when you're sick, it's impossible to imagine being healthy. It's kind of, I guess that's the mindset that we're coming out of now, is that immediately you just almost forget what it was like to be sick. Pretty soon we'll forget, oh yeah, there was this Trump guy in power and there was this whole trade war thing going on. And yeah, that pandemic thing, I guess that stopped as well, right? So there's these two lines of, or two tunnels that we're coming out of at the same time, or two sticks, I guess, on a fire, right? And the gasoline that's been poured on it, a la sort of quantitative easing, we're just waiting for a bit of a strike on that fire, right?
Totally. And you know, don't believe me, just watch. Don't take my word for it. Look at commodity prices and currencies. So all these little currencies, you know, Aussies, Kiwis, the loonie in Canada, Mexican peso, but then the big trade currencies, Korean won, Chinese yuan, they've all been really strong. And all the commodities have moved up really aggressively. So copper's at 8-year highs, energy's back in the 50s, mid-50s today. All your base metals have responded really well. Natural gas has bounced really aggressively. Freight rates have gone absolutely ballistic. That's with the United States, whilst not in lockdown, in a very serious state of sort of economic malaise. I know they just printed a 4% number, but, you know, they've got a long way to go. And Europe in all sorts of, you know, distress.
Mm.
So now...
It sounds almost like you're almost like cautiously optimistic here.
That's because I look at stuff that's had the stuffing kicked out of it for 3 years.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
So because the reverse of that trade is, you know, the COVID winners. So Amazon is the classic, right? So you've got this huge acceleration or bring forward of shopping, you know, Zoom calls like we're doing, et cetera, et cetera. Look, the growth rates and that stuff is going to tail off, you know. I don't want to do that. I want to come to Auckland and chat with you in person.
That's right.
So, you know, times that by hundreds of millions. And you know, that, and not just that, all this speaks to the cost of capital. So then we go back to interest rates. Interest rates are going to go up quickly and by quite a lot. In the world I'm painting for you, that is what's going to happen. So global real GDP growth in the next few quarters is going to be very high. That's not a guess. I mean, it is a guess. We can get extraneous forces that might prevent.
But I see what you're saying, though. Like with this model that you're building, those are the logical conclusions. Interest rates will go up and will bounce back quite severely because of all this cash that's in the system that perhaps wasn't there before that magnitude, right?
Yeah, that's right. There's a wrinkle around that, though, which is there's no such thing as the interest rate in any system. You know, I don't get to borrow at negative ever. I don't get to borrow at zero ever, right? So the policy rates that people fixate on, I think, stay very low for a very long time, probably less than what they think, because of what I said before. Central banks are telling elected officials to spend money, and they're telling market participants, yeah, we actually want inflation in the system. But off the back of that, market rates will change.
Yeah. So really it's an environment where, hey, it's okay to be, well, they're basically inflating some of the problem away, or that's the strategy here, isn't it?
Totally. I mean, this you know, symmetrical, it's a wrong term, but symmetrical inflation targeting, which they're talking about in the States, is effectively saying, hey, look, we want the target to be 2 because we've been below 2 for a long time. We're happy to have it be above 2 for quite a while.
Right. Okay.
To make up for lost time. So it's very odd. Right? I think it's very odd. The notion is that if 2 is the cap and you bounce off that and come back down, people's expectation will be below 2. And so therefore, they'll be too close to deflation for comfort. Because if you have a lot of debt in the system, you don't want deflation. That's toxic.
So that's the worst thing.
So there will be a tolerance for inflation, but that just reinforces the dynamic that I'm talking about. Because you're not going to get the choking off. The punch bowl is going to be left out in the open as the party is going bunter.
Nice.
And that's very different. Yeah. So Pre-1929, interbank rates were raised in August, before the crash in October. The Fed had started raising in 99 and into 2000, in advance of that event. That's not happening now. And it looked like economies were slowing down a bit. I don't know in 29, to be honest. They did look like they were slowing down in 2000. You did have this sort of, waning activity. That is not apparent. Certainly not yet, and probably not until the end of this year or something like that. But that said, markets pre-price stuff, so there's elements of pre-pricing there, and maybe it feels like it's all happened, because if I'm saying it, everybody knows it. I'm no brighter, or I don't have a better telescope than anybody else. So we must look for evidence that maybe this isn't fully done. And one just has to look at the global banking sector as an investment tool, wearable, and global energy, awful.
Yeah.
I mean, look at these global energy majors. They're about where they were in like the late 90s. In terms of, nominal share price. I don't mean valuation. I mean nominal share price. The share price, if you'd bought in like 97 and held till now, you made zero nominal dollars. Some of that's environmental considerations and appropriately so, but that just speaks to this point that the world is not at all excited about growth prospects or reflation or worried about inflation. We can see that in tips and break evens. They're not worried about inflation. People aren't worried about inflation. So that feels maybe like, hey, this guy's saying there's going to be inflation, and bond markets are saying there's not. Markets are never wrong. They just change, and they change quite quickly. The onset of inflation can come really very quickly.
And yeah, I just worry as well, like just on that, because if that punch bowl is left out, and if everybody in the party was getting slightly inebriated, and then someone shows up with a bunch of crack cocaine, it's going to the next level, right?
Hell yeah. I think it's a really strong possibility. I mean, so all we have are these sort of mental models and mathematical models of past events. And they're always wrong. They never capture anything, and in this instance, things are really quite extreme, and you could get to really quite extreme outcomes. But that goes back to this general cautionary principle. People must understand this is a really unusual time, and it's absolutely not the ideal time to be throwing a whole lot of money into markets as a buy and hold strategy. Now, why can I say that? Because the big years of gains are always after the market has collapsed. And I know, and I actually really have a strong sense that people feel like it did that in February and March of 2020 with COVID. It didn't do that at all. It did something like the reverse. So bank lending accelerated in that event. Corporate bond issuance accelerated in that event. Not in the first few weeks of it, to be fair, in that February 23 to March 19, I think it was. You did get a bit of a cessation there, but immediately you hit that low in late March. Everything just reopened. And as the recession actually started in the economy, lending growth increased into the economy and money supply exploded in the economy. And that's just never happened. Never happened in a recession. So it's a very unusual event. Now translate that over into equity markets. You didn't get a change of leadership. You didn't get the leaders going into the bubble period underperforming on the way down. You didn't get that at all. They actually performed about the same as the market and then bounced much more rapidly than the market. So you've got a reinforcement of the prior leadership. That's not what an end of a cycle looks like.
Just to make it really clear, what would an end of cycle scenario kind of look like if that was to be, quote unquote, a proper sort of correction, if you like?
So corporate spreads blow out. So what does that mean? Companies just can't borrow money as easily. They can, but at a much higher rate. Lots and lots of bankruptcies, lots and lots of unemployment, but for much longer periods of time than what we've witnessed. And capital isn't injected into the economy. Capital is taken out of the economy. So as policy rates fall in a recession, corporate rates are going up in a recession. Because I'm now a banking credit officer at a bank, and you own a tire franchise or something. Yeah, and you come to me and say, hey, Julian, can I have some money? And I'm like, yeah, unemployment just went to 12%, so no. But the interest rate went down. Not yours, buddy. Yours went up.
Risk premium.
Because you have bad credit now. Right? So the spread goes out. That didn't happen. You know, I mean, there's great uncertainty. So if you go and look on the, you know, the sort of Federal Reserve, you know, the United States Central Bank's sort of data bit, the St. Louis Fed, you know, that they have these shadings for when recessions happen, and they've got a different color on this one because it says we don't know if it's over. We don't know what it is. Right? So it is a very, very unusual event with huge liquidity being forced into the system in the presence of, you know, very, very significant inequality of income and wealth. And kids like me are sitting at, you know, sitting at home, and they've still got their job because, of, you know, I work from home now. I won't forever, but I'm working home right now. And so, oh, I have a bit of a dabble. And all my living expenses went away because I can't go outside. So that's just a tiny part of it. But it's a very, very unusual event with in the presence of incredibly high asset prices. None of us can know how it all ends. For God's sake, be careful.
Let's talk about that liquidity event that you just referred to there, just to flesh out what you mean by that. You're talking specifically about quantitative easing or money printing from, you know, central banks around the world. That obviously filled in that gigantic pothole, which potentially made, you know, freed up the credit to flow shortly after that event last year. What happens when we do kind of come to the end of this tunnel? The, you know, the punch bowl is still out. Strong indications that rates will stay low for longer. We're okay with inflation. You're going to soak in it for longer. It's going to be great for your skin, all the rest of it. But what happens when that catches up to us? Surely it's going to overshoot. I'm thinking it's not just going to be above 2% by a little bit. There's no way that they can actually control things beyond that. Like, are we talking about potentially a situation where it could go, say, even to hyperinflation, where things kind of quickly lose control, do you think?
Hyperinflations are rare. They don't ever happen in functional economies. I get annoyed when people talk about, you know, an Australian, New Zealand, American economy going into hyperinflation. That they happen generally in the presence of extreme economic damage. So think about Weimar Germany, which is really kind of the
reference point.
That's the most impactful hyperinflation, because it still today influences European Central Bank policy. I promise you. The guys and girls, they're mostly German, and they mostly have this hard money fixation, and it's mostly because of this inherited memory of Weimar. Why did Weimar happen? France invaded the Ruhr. Like, France took the industrial heartland of Germany. Right. And then said, hey, guys, we want 6% of your GDP, having taken your industrial heartland. Have a go at that. Impossible. It was impossible. It was not because a functioning government said, oh, you know what? I'm going to print a bit more money. That is not what happened. These things don't happen. You know, Zimbabwe happened because they stuffed up their whole export industry, which was the only way they got hard currency. You had that sort of land appropriation stuff. And you devastated that industry, so you have no income at the same time as you're printing incredible amounts of money. So that is the model people have to have in mind for hyperinflation. Very rare, happens in the presence of immense economic damage. Accelerating inflation of the type we saw in the 70s requires a really different institutional context to what we've got in the economy. And I mean, Labor's got to be much more powerful. Not for a while.
So you're
not
talking about wages pushing inflation, right?
Wages. Yeah. It's absolutely wages, right? So, by the way, I think we do have very significant wage inflation, but it's only in tiny elements of the economy.
What I'm hearing from you is that, hey, we might be coming towards the light at the end of the tunnel here. things, it's a bit too soon to say, but if this model that you're building is correct, maybe there's some optimism sooner rather than later, and we should start to be looking up. It might feel like things are high right now, but things could even go to the next level. Is that correct?
Not quite. I actually wouldn't mind, giving you a little bet that markets are at or very close to their high watermark for a very long time.
Right.
In the aggregate, driven by a pretty limited number of stocks. But that doesn't mean there's no money to be made, right? I mean, so equity markets went nowhere from about 65 to about 85, 1965 about 1985. Not quite. It's like more like 66 to 83. Peter Lynch, when he was running the Magellan Fund for Fidelity, I mean, that guy compounded like nearly 20% a year. Hmm. Now, why? It's because he had a similar event in the early, in the late 60s, driven up, by this immense, there's a sort of mini tech bubble. IBM, right. EDS, Lockheed Martin, Textron, Westinghouse, blah, 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 Polaroid kind of, right? So you had this Nifty 50 type thing, and then it just left all the rest of the market behind. We did something a bit like that post-99 through to 84. We outperformed markets by about 180% over about 4 years. They're rough numbers. Please see our website for disclaimer, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not promising anything like that in the future. What I'm saying is that stuff can happen in markets that go nowhere. And I think it will happen at some point, because the difference between good and bad, expensive, cheap, has never been this great.
Right. I hear what you're saying.
In the history of markets that we have data on, it's never been like this.
Yeah.
Some of that's accurate, and some of that is, technological change and all the rest of it. But please do understand that we all live every minute of every day at the technological boundary of society, right? Like, technology was really exciting in the 20s. Automation, electrification, radio, automobile. God damn, that is incredible social change. I mean, I think that dwarfs what we're going through. You went from walking or riding a horse, right, to a recognizable modern society, right, with radios and, cars and all that, right? So enormous change, and it was really exciting, and it got people really excited, and they lost a whole lot of money, right? Now, I am not predicting that about the future, because remember, I don't know. I'm saying the probability is pretty high.
Mm.
But what gets left behind in these events, that's where I think things are really exciting.
Yeah.
And that is stuff like, energy, financials, basically all your emerging market type stuff. Japan in particular, Europe to a lesser degree, there's nuance around Europe. But so there is stuff you can go and own because it's been left behind. But if we're talking about aggregate market levels, remember the start of the conversation, I was saying we've never been this expensive.
Mm. Yeah.
In history, and ever's a long time. So that does speak to a general cautionary principle about wanting to take all your capital and shove it in the markets. Mm. I just don't think that's a great idea.
Because I was going to, but no, I won't now.
Yeah, exactly. Don't.
No, that's good. That's a good perspective. So just tell me before we finish up, what's your perspective on, gold, mining stocks, industrial stuff? What do you think about that sector at the moment? Is it, like, I know with oil, right? Surely the demand will come on at some stage. I know nothing at all about that market at all, but I'm just keen to hear your perspective.
Yep. Gold hates a reflation. So, as inflation and growth accelerate, gold gets left behind. I will always own some gold to very varying degrees, because the monetary denouement from here on out, I don't think there's any way out except to print. That's the only answer. And I think the cessation of that process is so unrecognizable, I wouldn't want to guess at it. But I would draw some broad parameters around it. the dollar-based international exchange system is frankly stupid. Everybody knows it, and we all sort of skirt around it. And it's going to take probably a crisis to break it. And so I need to have a little bit of that sort of barbarous relic to ensure against that outcome, but not to, you know, in varying degrees at different times. When you want to own gold is in a, you know, falling growth and falling rate environment in particular, you know, so real rates are low, but the economy is not doing anything for these other you know, things that are exciting. So point one. The other point around broader commodities and energy, they have never been so cheap in the history of capitalism relative to equities. So would I own some? Yeah, I would.
Copper, oil, all that sort of stuff. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. I do, you know, sort of shudder to mention oil. I absolutely know that the climate has changed at our hands, and I absolutely know that we have to use less of it, and I absolutely know we're addicted to the crap. So, you know, someone's going to make the money. So energy is part of the mix. It just has to be. It has to be part of the calculation. If you want to avoid it because of ethical concerns, feel free, but you must acknowledge its existence. It's one of the biggest industries in the world. But it'll be a very different industry in 20 years. And I'm really hopeful about that. I mean, we'll be very, very electrified in the transport sense in 10 years, which is great. But look, passenger transport is 25% of oil demand. But energy is a huge industry that dwarfs all the metals. And in a reflation environment, it's part of the mix. And then all your base metals, I think the next 10 years is spectacular for stuff like copper, less so zinc,
silver,
copper, nickel, cobalt, you know, those battery metals, really important. Steel prices have gone through the roof already. These sort of boring old pretty crappy things. But in a world that can grow a bit, you don't want to marry them, but you do want to date them. Nice. You know, these are not compounders that you can just sit on forever. I don't want to suggest that, but they're of interest here.
So before we finish up, Julian, do you want to just tell me about, you know, a couple of other things that you're thinking about before we finish up for our audience?
Sure. I think really as a summary, I would say we all must be reminding ourselves to exercise a general cautionary principle, even as markets might push higher. Investors have crowded into a limited number of positions in tech and related exposures that are potentially very dangerous, but there's, you know, vast tracts of the rest of the world, you know, so basically anything non-US dollar denominated that look very, very interesting and can make you money for the next 10 years, 5 or 10 years. But it is a very, very elevated point in terms of the history of market pricing and valuation, and people need to have some caution.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Julian. Now, if people want to find out a little bit more about what Platinum Asset Management is about, where's the best place that we can point them to?
Go to www.platinum.com.au and have a look at our website and speak to a financial advisor. You know, if you take any area of your life seriously, you get coaching. So I would do that.
Yeah, awesome. Appreciate that. Okay, well, thank you very much, Julian. Enjoy the rest of your evening over there.
Absolutely, I will. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you, Darcy. I always enjoy talking to you.
Good on you. All right, thanks very much.
All right, so is it possible we are heading for a crash? This is what many are seeing right now. Interest rates have kicked all assets, it seems, into overdrive. Well, maybe not so much gold and silver like you would expect, but everything else seems to be going into the next level. Those in the camp that believe we're heading for a cliff, Thelma and Louise style perhaps, believe it has a lot to do with demographics. All these baby boomers withdrawing their money and slowing down and not spending so much. Often Japan's 30-year V-shaped recovery is the reference point they use. Now, this makes sense to some extent, but while baby boomers may be checking out, the millennial investors are checking in, and they're doing it with a vengeance. Now, on another layer, there's a growing suspicion that quantitative easing won't be pulled back. Now, not just anytime soon, but anytime ever. Now, this is the fuel that could ignite one heck of a fire when people realize that these rules are kind of set in stone. Now, all this points to a rate of growth way further up that exponential curve that you're already not comfortable with, way up where you thought we could never go, potentially. Now, I've also been toying with this odd idea, and it's only odd to me, I suppose, as I haven't yet heard this anywhere else. So, yep, it could be completely off the charts crazy. But our return that we should be getting from our investing when we do it should compensate us for a few things, right? Like it should compensate us for the fees that we have to pay when we invest, the time that it takes us to do it, the risk that we're taking that in the short term we could lose money. It should reward us for opportunity costs, and it should also, more importantly, reward us for inflation. Now that last one is important, as I think we're missing something. The question many have raised recently is, why no inflation given all this money printing? The thinking then goes on to suggest perhaps we can print our way out of this whole mess with just more currency. Doesn't seem to be any impact. Why not? Let's just do it. Perhaps the amazing returns we're now getting on our Sharesies and Hatch accounts have actually got something built within it. It actually has future inflation built into the returns we're seeing today, the inflation that we cannot yet see. In other words, by the time we cash in our portfolio and spend it in the future, adjusted for inflation, we're actually potentially no better off at all. We're taking a huge risk, therefore, to invest in this dynamic environment, but are the returns actually appropriate? So, what do we do? What's a rational response to an irrational situation? Are you going to stay away? Stay safe? Cash in? Sit on the sidelines? Or cautiously scale into some of these riskier investments? What are you thinking? Are you going to sell up and sit on the sidelines, call for the end of the world so that hopefully the market hears you? Or are you diligently going to keep building, construct a smart, well-diversified portfolio, sit tight, because knowing that in the long term, you should actually be okay? So we don't know how it's all going to play out, but it's certainly an interesting thing to watch. Anyway, that's it from me. I hope you have a great day. Cheers.
Thanks for listening into the NZ Everyday Investor Podcast, a show that's about helping you, the everyday Kiwi, build wealth. To learn more about the show, please visit nzeverydayinvestor.com or visit your show notes on your podcast player. There, you can find out how to make contact, sign up to our newsletter, and check out previous episodes. We're on a mission to increase wealth for everyday Kiwis. If you'd like to support what we do, then there's a few things that you can do. Write a review on whatever platform you're listening to this on. Share episodes with your friends or support us financially on Patreon. Before we finish up, just another reminder that what was discussed today is for educational purposes only. Ideally, before acting on anything covered here, please contact your trusted financial advisor or do your own research. Hope you enjoyed today's episode, and we'll catch you next time around.